Turn in the Word of God to Genesis chapter 38. And as you read it, we immediately say it is no surprise that Christians can be stupid. That's not a surprise. Nor is it any surprise that Christians sin. But it is frequently a surprise how nasty, mean, and deceptively wicked they can be. That is something of a surprise. And when you read Genesis 38, you really have to pinch yourself to remind you that this isn't just Judah. This is one of the patriarchs. This is one of the sons of Jacob. He is in the covenant line. And as we shall see, one of the ancestors of the Lord himself. But why is it here? Why is it in the Bible? And why is it located in this particular history? Well, the reason why it is specifically here, chapter 38, and not 51 or any other place, it's to show us why Judah would not be the deliverer of Israel from bondage, but Joseph. That's why God put it here. It is strategically placed. The narrative begins by telling us about Joseph. It's still the history of Jacob. It's still the pilgrimage of Jacob, but you have this section about Joseph, and then it abruptly stops and it turns to tell us about Judah. So it shows us why Judah will not deliver Israel, but Joseph. It's also to show us only God can preserve Judah, for Judah can't even preserve himself. Judah is not his own keeper. The Lord is his keeper. Only God can keep him. Now, we studied chapter 37 under the title, Life from Below Without God. You may have thought, well, how bad can it get? Chapter 37 was pretty woeful. Not that 34 was any better, but chapter 37 was appalling. Well, this is worse. So I've simply called it Life at the Bottom. Life at the Bottom. And this history is so awkward, so embarrassing, and so shocking that a number of commentators actually say it should not even be preached. Leupold, for example, writes, entirely unsuited to homiletical use. In other words, don't even think about preaching this chapter. You may read it privately, but don't preach it. Well, God obviously disagrees with Leupold, because he's put it in the Word of God, and you can't preach about Joseph without dealing with chapter 38. You can't simply say, well, that's embarrassing, so I'm going to jump on over to chapter 39 because, this is much more pleasant. But you can't understand chapter 39 without hearing about chapter 38. And there's a reason for that, and you'll see that when you come to chapter 39. Well, chapter 37 ends with Joseph in Egypt, and God immediately then turns to this, and he is saying to us directly, here's why Joseph delivers. So what do we have in this chapter? Well, the first thing you have in verses 1 to 5 is the waywardness of God's people. The waywardness of God's people. From the very first verse, you immediately begin to hold your breath. Because Judah is going in the wrong direction. He went down from his brethren and turned into a certain Adullamite whose name was Hara. You immediately sense this is not going to end well. Notice it says he went from his brethren to. Now that's important. He went from to. He went from his brethren to this Adullamite. And then it says he went down from and turned into. So the very construction of the verse is forewarning you, it is saying to you, the hearer and the reader, now listen carefully, this is not going well. Because Judah is separating himself from Israel. He turned from his brethren. So he's separating himself from his brethren while making friends with the Canaanites. Later on, he refers to this person as his friend. He's making friends with the Canaanites. In other words, it is flesh before faith. Flesh before faith. And you immediately begin to see how this chapter resonates with us. Because how often the believer is like that. We put the flesh before faith. Now these opening words, I should say to you, stand in marked contrast to the opening words of chapter 39. In chapter 38, verse 1, Judah went down. He goes voluntarily, but in chapter 39, verse 1, Joseph is brought down. He is brought forcefully. So what happens in Joseph's life in chapter 39 is not of his own doing. He's been forced into that situation. Judah goes willingly. And how often we're like that. We walk with our eyes open willingly into circumstances and situations unfavorable. And also remember, going back to chapter 37, it was this Judah who suggested selling Joseph. Profit before principle. Let's sell Joseph. Let's sell him into slavery. But you know, who's the real slave? Judah is the slave. He's a slave, shall we put it this way, as politely as we can. He's a slave to his glands. Verse 2 shows the inevitable. Look at the way it's put. Judah saw. And this raises the question, what kind of relationship did he actually have with this Canaanite? He saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her, went in unto her, and she conceived and bare a son. Well, the answer is there in the text. The text uses three verbs for Judah and three for Shua. So in verse 2, he saw, he took, he went in unto. In verse 3, she conceived, she bare, and called. And all this raises an even further question. Is any good going to come of this? You know, it's just one wrong turn after another. It is just a downward walk, and every step is bringing him to an even worse position. Will any good come of this? Well, for a moment, let's just pause for a moment and say, well, on the one hand, we remember the promise of God to Abraham in Genesis 12, verses 2 and 3, where God says to Abraham, I will make of thee a great nation, and in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. Is this how God is going to do it? So we'll hold that question and answer for a moment. Because on the other hand, there is God's command to remain separate from the Canaanites. And Judah is disregarding the practice of his grandfather. You think of Abraham 24:3. His great-grandfather, we might say, 24:3, I will make thee swear by the Lord, the God of heaven, the God of the earth, that thou shalt not take a wife unto my son of the daughters of the Canaanites. So he's ignoring Abraham's own practice. He's ignoring Isaac's practice. In Genesis 28:1, Isaac called Jacob, blessed him, and charged him, and said, thou shalt not take a wife of the daughters of Canaan. So there's a lineage of practice, a lineage of obedience to the command of God. And bear in mind that the Canaanites were under the curse, Genesis 9:25. And also God had sworn that in due time the Canaanites would be dispossessed, that God would throw them out of the land. He would destroy them. Chapter 15, verse 16. So when you read verses 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and 5, immediately you can see that Judah is disregarding the command of God and despising the promise of God. You see how bad it is. He is disregarding the command not to marry into the Canaanites. And he is despising the promise of God that he will dispossess the Canaanites. And yet it's worse than that. In light of Genesis 12 verses 2 and 3, Judah is now failing to enlarge and extend the seed of the woman. He is, in fact, mingling the seed of the woman with the seed of the serpent. It's Genesis 6 all over again. And, of course, by this point, we begin to shudder. We begin to say, this is tragic. But let's remember, we can be like him. Here then is Judah's stupidity, sinfulness, and slighting of both the command and the promise of God. Duty and responsibility thrown into the wind. The glands have taken over. But then secondly, in verses 6 to 11, the severity of God's judgment. Now, after verses 3, 4, and 5, all these children are born. This is a long period of time. Decades are passing. These infants are becoming children, teenagers, growing up into adulthood. And everything seems to be going well. In fact, not only are three sons born, they grew into men, and the first one, the eldest one, he gets married. He marries a girl called Tamar. No doubt it was a great wedding. All the relatives came. And it seemed as if, well, despite all that had been going on, despite the fact he had disregarded the command, he had despised the promise, despite all that, it seemed as if the blessing of heaven was falling upon Judah. After all, no lightning struck Judah in verse 1 or verse 2. He didn't become disabled in verse 3 or 4 or 5. No lightning, no earthquakes. He didn't suddenly fall seriously ill. And indeed, in verse 6, all is going very well. But then we come to verse 7. The first thing we're told is that Ur was wicked, so God slew him. That's all we're told. Just put there very starkly and plainly. He was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and so the Lord killed him. And second, we see Onan's disobedience, and God slew him, verses 8 through 10. Now, after what happened to her, I suppose we must, for a moment, consider Onan. You can see his objections to what is being asked of him. After Ur has been slain, he is now number one. He is now the eldest. What does that mean? He inherits. But he inherits with a double portion because he's the eldest. But if Tamar has a son, the son becomes the eldest, takes precedence. Greed is driving Onan. He's going to lose out. Greed isn't tolerated by God. So what he did was wicked. He refused to honour his duty that was laid upon him. Of course, we might say, but you know, isn't God harsh here? Is it not rather extreme? Well, just remember Shorter Catechism 84. What doth every sin deserve? Every sin deserveth God's wrath and curse, both in this life and that which is to come. And the moment you consider that, the Lord's people never say God is too harsh, because we should have been damned for all eternity. What doth every sin deserve? But through all of these verses, you also pick up on Judah's callousness. You see, sin hardens the heart. And you will notice that Judah doesn't refer to Tamar. First, he said, go in unto thy brother's wife. Doesn't even mention her name. She doesn't matter to him. He's callous. Sin hardens her heart. Well, what now for Judah? He has lost two sons, and duty dictates that the third son, Shelah, should abide by the obligation laid upon him. But Judah hesitates. Superstition takes over. You see, Judah actually feels, you notice in verse 11, lest peradventure he die also, as his brethren did. Judah feels to see God slew the other two. So now he's superstitious. Maybe there's a problem here with Tamar. Maybe she's the reason why they've been killed. And so he's got a predicament. And in his predicament, pragmatism takes over. And so he makes a promise to her of Shelah, and he sends her off to her father's house. But again, you see that callousness. What's going to happen to Tamar? She's in a sort of a limbo situation. She's promised, yet she's abandoned. She is widowed, yet seemingly betrothed, and yet she can't do anything. Because if she tries to marry someone else, well, that's going to be wrong too. And yet, she remains unmarried. What about her husband's lineage? Everything's in limbo. God's judgment has made such an impact that a stalemate, it seems, has been reached. So here is Tamar, widowed, childless, promised, yet everything is uncertain. Judah is actually facing extinction. His whole line is about to be extinct. Think about the consequences of that. The line of Judah is about to be extinct. Because Shelah cannot marry anyone else. He must first do his duty to Tamar. And yet, he may be slain too. The severity of God's judgment. What's going to happen to Judah? Which brings me to the third point in this rather long section, verses 12 through 26. And as we have seen so often in all our Old Testament studies, God doesn't work in this pristine, hermetically sealed situation. He works here, where there's all the sludge and the grime and the nastiness of life. In fact, the construction of the chapter highlights this. Because if you look at those verses, verses 1 to 11, it covers about 20 years. Whereas verses 12 to 30 covers about 9 months. So you've got the fast pace of the first 11 verses, and suddenly everything grinds to a snail's pace. It's fascinating the way God has constructed this narrative. So what God is saying, you know, all these other events, let's just run through them quickly. But you see these 9 months, this is where we're going to take our time. Snail's pace. And it's almost like watching a train wreck happening. Everything's in slow motion. You can actually see the crash coming. And it begins with death. Verse 12, Judah's wife Shua dies. Now obviously it is quite clear, despite the beginning in verse 2 and 3, he had come to love her. But what he doesn't know, but we know, that's what heightens the tension. We know what he doesn't know. Tamar has finished waiting. She's not going to wait any longer. And she begins to act. Yes, we might ask, is she to be commended for her action? Well, if we put it this way, is she to be commended for her folly? And you get the answer. Because the penalty for her action is death. Deuteronomy 22, verses 23 and 4 lays down the penalty for what she is doing. All harlots were to be removed. And she is looking like one. But we do know something. She's not stupid. We know that she is cunning, clever. You see that when she insists upon a pledge in verse 18, that what's the payment going to be? Oh, it's going to be an animal, a kid from the flock. I'll send you a lamb. So there's the payment. But what pledge will you give me until I receive the payment? The modern equivalent, I suppose, might be leaving your mobile, the keys of your car, or the front door key in your credit card. I suppose you might say that's the modern equivalent, because that's pretty much what he gives her, everything with his name on it that identifies her. The signet, the bracelet, the staff. All that identifies this belongs to me. That is Judah. And again, you will notice three verbs. Gave, came, conceived. He gave it her, came in unto her, and she conceived by him. And she's gone. She just vanishes into thin air. And Judah, of course, sends the payment, and he wants his pledge back. But he can't find her. It's all a mess, isn't it? But the mess gets worse. We are told 3 months after the news comes about Tamar, verse 24, and Judah is outraged. he's outraged. He says, "Well, just burn her. No trial, no inquiry." He just hears the news and says, "Well, let's burn her. I'm not going to have this in this house." And so while he's busy stoking the fire, getting it all nice and hot for Tamar to be dragged out and thrown into the fire, she waits until the very last moment. Again, we see something of her cleverness. She waits until the last moment, you know, when she's just about to be chucked into the fire. She says, "Oh, by the way, you want to know who the father is? Well, there's his ID. Who owns this? Who owns the bracelet, the staff, the signet?" Well, of course, this just hit a crisis. What's going to happen now? Will Judah admit it? Well, we're told that he did. Verse 26, Judah acknowledged him and said, "She hath been more righteous than I, because that I gave her not to Shelah my son, and he knew her again no more." But the chapter doesn't end in the mess within God's providence. We come fourthly, verses 27 and 30, to the triumph of God's grace. The triumph of God's grace. Twins are born, like Jacob and Esau, and like them they struggle. And we have this remarkable reversal of births. Technically, Zara is first, yet he's born second. Perez is second, yet is born first. Now, there is no logical reason for this. There's no biological reason for this. And yet it happens. Why did it happen? God made a difference. According to his sovereign rule, what is the rule? The elder shall serve the younger. But you mustn't miss something. Two things have actually happened. The mess within God's providence, you see it all in its ugliness, and yet two things happen. First thing that happens, God preserves Judah. He preserves the line of Judah, the tribe of Judah. Will exist. And second, God fulfills his plan and purpose. He fulfills his plan. His purposes come to pass. And that purpose that comes to pass is in chapter 39 and 40 through to chapter 50, but ultimately will take you down to the New Testament. And you know, you cannot read the chapter and you cannot read these final verses and avoid the sheer thrill, not at the sin, but at how all this sludge is woven together to fulfill God's will. That's the thrill. That's the thing that encourages. That's the thing that excites. It doesn't make the sin any less sinful. It doesn't make the sin any more pleasant. In fact, to the contrary, you see the sheer sinfulness of sin and the depravity of it all and the wickedness of it all. And yet, you just stand back and marvel that God in his greatness, he weaves it all together and it all fulfills his plan. It's so exciting, isn't it? Well, let's come to applications. First of all, for your delight and encouragement. What is the area of delight and encouragement for us? It is this, as I said, that God will accomplish his purpose through both obedience and disobedience, through faithfulness and deception. And you see it in the life of Judas, don't you? Judas wanted to sell Christ. He wanted to betray him. He wanted the money. It's all his own doing. And yet, God uses it to fulfill his will. So God uses Tamar's deception to preserve the line of Judah that results in Perez, who in due time becomes the ancestor of David and therefore the ancestor of the Messiah. One commentator writes, God makes the rotten to serve the glorious. What's the glorious? The birth of Christ. So God makes the rotten serve the glorious. That's what makes everything so thrilling. So let me say to you, friends, you cannot be discouraged about the present, nor the future. You can't be discouraged by it. I know with all this rottenness in our nation, all this rottenness even in our own lives and in our own country, but you cannot be discouraged by it all. What Judah fails to do, Providence will accomplish. Judah failed to extend the seed of the woman, the line of Abraham, but Providence accomplished it. But then secondly, a warning. And the warning is this: who you cozy up to in life may actually be the enemy of the kingdom of God. Judah makes the enemy his friend while distancing himself from the covenant community, from the covenant people of God. Now, granted indeed that some Christians are nasty, mean, and deplorable. And the longer you live, the more nasty Christians you meet. Christians shouldn't be nasty. They should not be mean. They should not be deplorable. Christians should be civilized, pleasant, Christ-like, God-honoring. But though Christians are nasty and mean, is not a reason to make the Canaanites our friends. And the Canaanites can be very pleasant. I mean, look at this guy, Hara. Look at this woman, Shua. I have no doubt they were very pleasant people. Civilized, courteous. We can at least say Shua was faithful in her marriage. Some Canaanites are decent people. They are dependable. They're civilized. But they're still the enemy of God's kingdom. We mustn't forget that. Yes, there are some Christians, and we were brought up to pass yourself, was the phrase. For some people, that's about all you can get over. You just pass yourself with them and bid them the time of day and so on and move on. Meddle not with those given to change is another rule we have. And there are some that are as changeable as the weather, so you keep your distance, and rightly so. But that doesn't mean that the Canaanites become our friends. So Judah is a warning to us. But then thirdly, an encouragement also, a dark day is not midnight. You know, there's surprising hope in Genesis 38. Where is the hope? Well, in the first place, Tamar's determination to extend the covenant line. This is a surprise because she was a Canaanite. And it is evident that she has embraced something of Israel's God. Tamar, despite everything that is against her, she does extend the line of Abraham. She still wants to extend and maintain the line of Judah and the line of Abraham. She didn't go off and say, well, you know, I was a Canaanite. Well, I'll just go and move in with a Canaanite and I'll have children to Canaanites. I'll get married to one. She doesn't do that. her determination to extend the covenant line. The second encouragement is Judah's own transformation. Because what happens here is, in fact, a turning point in Judah's life. In due time, he will return to be part of the covenant people of God. In due time, he will show concern for Jacob's welfare and even offer himself in Benjamin's place. In due time. And in due time, Jacob will give him the greatest of all blessings of the messianic promise in Genesis 49. It's in due time. So chapter 38 is a turning point. And don't we look for turning points in the lives of people? I say to you, do not despair. You may tear your hair out in anguish over some, but do not despair. Look at Tamar. Look at Judah. And fourthly, for your instruction. Judah is an abject failure in both word and deed. He lived by his glands instead of by grace. When Tamar is accused, he becomes indignant. He wants her punished in the most extreme manner without even a formal trial. And there is a fascinating emphasis. Judah sends a lamb to retrieve his pledge, but he didn't pay his own pledge to Tamar. What did he tell her? When Shelah is grown, he will marry you. But he's insisting on Tamar returning his pledge. God finds him out. But if Judah is a failure, his acknowledgement of his sin is a positive lesson to copy. You know, the hardest thing for Christians to do is to put their hand up and say, you were right. That seems to be the hardest thing for some Christians to do, to admit that they were wrong. It may, you know, dent your pride to say you were wrong. Say you were wrong may cost you respect and friends or whatever. That's okay. But don't we admire Judah here? So if we can admire Judah for this acknowledgement, and after all that Judah has done, he does put his hand up and say, actually, those items are mine. I'm the one to blame, not her. My fault. So if his failure is a warning, his acknowledgement is an encouragement. And then fifthly and finally, all for good. Perez, even though he's born in this situation, he's in the line of the Messiah. So he's listed in Matthew 1 verse 3, Luke 3, 33. He's also mentioned in Ruth 4 verses 18 to 22. So you have Judah's wickedness, Tamar's sin, and it all combines to bring about the survival of the tribe of Judah, the extension of the seed of the woman, the fulfillment of the promise to Abraham, and ultimately the birth of the Messiah. Now, some might say, but doesn't this tarnish the name of Christ? Doesn't this tarnish the reputation of Christ? Well, here's what John Calvin says. And using Philippians 2, verses 6 to 7, he writes, now, although at first sight the dignity of Christ seems to be somewhat tarnished by such dishonor, Genesis 38, the greatest disgrace of the tribe of Judah, yet Since here also is seen that emptying spoken of by Paul, it rather redounds to his glory than detracts in the least degree from it. So rather than diminishing the glory of Christ, it redounds to the glory of Christ that the Saviour came from such a line. It's the mercy of God. It's the grace of God. It's the wonder of God that He has woven it all together to bring us through that line to the Messiah. All for good. What is it that Paul says? We know that all things work together for good. To them that love God, of course. To them who are the called. All for good according to His purpose. But it's still all for good. May the Lord bless these words to your hearts.